Hello, everyone. I'm Hal Eisner. This is What the Hal. And, you know, we're looking at a very serious subject this episode. It's the train wreck that happened back in 2008. The month was September. The date was the 12th. 165 people were injured. 25 were killed. And the anniversary in this September, it just brings back a lot of difficult memories. But in the time that's passed, there have been many changes to improve safety, and that's some of what you're about to hear as we talk about the Chatsworth train wreck anniversary. First of all, let me just introduce all of you. Keith Milhouse was a board member of Metrolink. Richard Katz, also a board member of Metrolink. This is in the past. And then Claudia Souser, who sadly lost her husband Doyle in this train crash. And that, you know, just tell us about Doyle. I mean, who was Doyle? What did he do? What was he like?
Doyle was my best friend. We've been married for 29 years. We father of three children. He loved dearly. He was a hardworking man, grew up on a farm in eastern Colorado, and was a CPA by training, but he was a real creative businessman. So he worked, he loved to get a business and fix it up. But he was a CEO for Stockton Products, and they did wire products for the building industry. So he was always commuting into Burbank.
How old was he?
56.
56. Some people found out reasonably quickly that they had lost somebody. You did not.
No, I got a phone call right away that this train had crashed, which wasn't the train he normally took. But he took this train because he was coming home early to help me make dinner for a single mom from our church. But we didn't know anything. Friends were going to the hospitals and different things, and nobody knew anything. Even the next morning, it took probably till early afternoon before they had actually moved the car, the Metrolink car, and then they said his body, I think, was underneath. He was the last body found.
Those are images that just you can't get out of your
They're
head.
Hard to look back yeah. at, actually.
You're a very religious family.
Well, not religious. We just believe in God.
Yeah, I know, but when I say that, I mean, you were a religious school teacher.
Well, our faith is real. It's strong. We have, you know, we know who's taking care
of us. It wasn't dashed by this, like, God,
well,
why me?
Yeah, there's a lot you have to struggle, like the whys and, you know, what good is this to have three teenage kids without a dad? You know, that, but even if you talk to any of them today, they would say this has formed their character greatly. And I know my oldest daughter said it changed her so much. But I think for the good, we've been driven even closer to God. And there's lots of struggles, but our characters are
the oldest better. Daughter. The oldest daughter is Mackenzie. And I did talk to Mackenzie.
Oh, actually, my oldest daughter is Kelsey.
Oh, I get it. Yeah. Okay. So yeah. How old is Kelsey?
Kelsey's 29.
And Mackenzie is 22.
Mackenzie's 22. And
okay.
A son in the middle, Zach, who's 25.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. So Mackenzie I talked to from San Diego.
Right.
The other day. And you said to me that she was robbed of her childhood. And I asked her about that. And she told me that she agreed with that. But I was also interested in how this shaped her life. And here's a little bit of that conversation.
I think it had a really big impact on how I viewed relationships in general, because I didn't have that male role model there in my life anymore to kind of guide me and, you know, be that encouraging presence and show me how I'm supposed to be loved. And so I think I struggled a lot through high school, and I think it was a lot of it was because I didn't have my dad around, and it was still such a traumatic thing for me.
Your mom told me that what happened that day robbed your childhood.
Yes, 100%.
You agree with that?
I just felt like it was my job to be with my mom, so I spent all my time like at home with her, and we just did everything together, and I didn't get to being normal, like high school kid.
I want to know if there's something that you observed of your mother while you guys were going through this that you've never really had a chance to tell her.
That'll make me cry. Oh my goodness. I have never seen someone take such a huge tragedy and turn it into something so incredible. I mean, she became two parents overnight. And she was like our hero. I mean, she still is. Like, I called her like 10 minutes ago just because I was stressed out. I mean, she's literally my hero. And I understand every day why my dad married her, because, man, she's awesome. And she just stepped up. And I don't think I could do that. I mean, I got to walk kind of side by side with my mom and see this transformation of our family being so grief stricken, and I got to see what a strong woman she really is and what a role model she is to me. And I'm so proud to be her daughter.
She's sitting here in the studio. I want to know what you want to say to her.
Thank you for taking the hardest thing in my life and turning it into a way for our family to grow stronger and closer. And thank you for just being the most rock star of a mom that you possibly could be.
What's your reaction to some of what you heard?
Well, I think Mackenzie, I don't think I even realized how much it really affected her. She just turned 13 like 3 days after the crash. In fact, we were preparing for her birthday party the night before. And so all of her teen years, she maneuvered without a father. But she was very concerned about me too, which I didn't think I realized as much. We were just trying to maneuver through this, all these things we didn't know how to do. We were doing alone, and my oldest daughter, Kelsey, was off to college. She'd just gone. And so Mackenzie and I did do a lot together, and I think it wasn't a normal teenage years at all.
Well, she says that she felt that she had to be there for you.
Right.
Yeah, like she had to hold you up, take care of you.
Yeah, and you know, you don't realize your kids are feeling that and going through that when you're feeling like, I've got to be two parents to these kids and make all these financial decisions and all these moral decisions and all these decisions about life.
Before we move around the table, I do want to ask you, you know, this happened on September the 12th of 2008. We're in that anniversary window. And you shake your head like it's hard to believe.
It is hard to believe. I mean, 10 years, you just kind of get in some rhythm of life, and then that anniversary comes up. I mean, every year we kind of dread September 12th. For a few years, we used to go away or go to dinner or get out of town. But for the 10-year, this is really kind of a major thing. Lots of
it
people
is, isn't it?
Yeah, they're very interested in it, and it's kind of brings up a lot of the old images and feelings. It's kind of something to work through.
Now, one who dealt with a lot of people who were in this kind of situation was Keith, because Keith was on the board representing Ventura County, and a lot of these people on the train were going back home to Ventura County. They had left Chatsworth. They were going into Simi Valley, which is the eastern part of Ventura County, and some of them lived in Moore Park, and some of them lived in Camarillo or Thousand Oaks. And what's your recall?
Well, the last two stops were in Ventura County. And I remember getting a call from my friend that day that said there had been a Metrolink accident. So I was at work. I logged on to my computer, and I saw the aerial overheads from the television news cameras and choppers. And at some point, the camera spun around. One of the first questions I had was the train being pushed or pulled, because that had been a big subject of discussion at the time, and the safety of one versus the other. But when I saw a different angle and realized what had happened, I almost literally became sick, because it was so powerful, and I knew that this was just going to be devastating. And subsequent to that, you know, I learned of who was on the train and the people that were on the train. And there were people I knew in the community that had been critically injured, people that had lost children. And at that point, you know, it's not a numbers thing. It was a situation where there were human beings, you know, sons, daughters, fathers, husbands, and it became just incumbent to do everything I could going forward. I couldn't undo what had happened, but making sure that it never happened again. I was blessed to have people put on the board subsequent to that, and the support of Mayor Rubio Rugosa and his appointment, Richard Katz, to transform rail safety, not only in Southern California, but the country.
You know, just to draw a picture here, and I don't mean to be too graphic, but I think it's unfair not to describe what happened here, because one train came out of the tunnel, the other one was about to approach a bend. As they both came around the curve, they basically only had 2 seconds to hit the air brakes. They only noticed each other at 4 seconds before impact.
They came around a blind curve. The freight train, the Metrolink train was supposed to wait for the freight train to pull into the siding much earlier. The engineer who was employed by Connex had been text messaging, ran through the red light, and in fact, you know, he was so involved with text messaging, never even hit the brakes. The freight train operator hit the brakes, but it was too little too late. And the impact, the force of it, telescoped the Metrolink engine back into the first passenger car, which is where most of the fatalities were.
So to translate that, basically one train went inside of the other.
Well, basically the freight train had its locomotive in front. The Metrolink train had its locomotive in front. The freight train was much heavier, and it, when it hit the Metrolink locomotive, pushed it back into the passenger car that was trailing behind the Metrolink locomotive. So the Metrolink locomotive had an incursion into the passenger car, the first car.
Well, which is why it was so devastating. And that was where Doyle was.
Yeah, we were told later that he was possibly in the first car and maybe even one of the first seats. I called his coworker and I said, did he leave early? Yes. In fact, but he said, you know, he's a little bit late to get catching that train. So he may have popped on. He always took the third car. He always was aware of things. And for him to be in the first car was unusual. To be on that train was...
Any thought why he might have done that?
He just wanted to get home, make that dinner for that gal, and thought, well, I'll take the first car this time. And
that gal was a person at church who was a single mom.
Right.
And he wanted to do something good for her.
Yeah, he just wanted to touch base with her teenage son. And she actually rang the doorbell a few hours later. It was pretty, she didn't know what was going on with flowers in her hand. And I it was a pretty hard scene that at the door that moment.
Richard was appointed by Mayor Villaraigosa back then. And you kind of jumped in there with both feet.
You know, it's interesting because one of the stories that doesn't get told a lot was the family at Metrolink. That is a very close-knit group of people, a lot of whom still work there, a lot of whom could have gone to work somewhere else after 2008, but they stayed. It's a family, and you know, they wanted to make it right, and it was inspiring in a way. You know, their resilience, the first responders, the families. I mean, you know, hopefully people listening to this will never have to experience what all of us went through that day and continue to go through it for many weeks after.
Now, did you get to the scene?
The mayor went, and Jaime de la Vega, his deputy for transportation, went. I stayed back because I just figured, you know, I wouldn't add anything there, and you didn't need more bodies there.
Keith, did you go?
I did not go. There was not a communication plan in place at Metrolink, and so I was getting sporadic updates. In fact, I was getting better updates from the news station. So I stayed in Ventura County. I tried to do what I could do there. I contacted the police departments in Simi Valley and Moore Park. I knew there would be cars left overnight. I wanted to make sure they were protected, watched, not vandalized, and then contacted the Ventura County Fire Department to make sure that we had chaplain resources available in case people were arriving there. I tried to figure out what I could do because I didn't know what to do.
Yeah, it was a feeling of hopelessness for a lot of people.
Well, and, you know, part of it, the mayor and I got on the train the next day, the first day of revenue service in Chatsworth to ride the train in, you know, as a way of telling people we had confidence in the system, we had confidence in the Metrolink folks, and that it was okay to ride the train to try and restore that confidence. But we also started working immediately on how do you make sure this doesn't happen again, and what else can you do? You know, we talk a lot about positive train control because it was such a milestone, and Metrolink literally created it from nowhere.
Explain it.
Positive train control is something that the National Transportation Safety Board had been asking for a decade, and they kept getting like patted on the head in Washington. They said, you know, it's not a big deal, no big deal, and they had been very serious about it. It is a satellite-based system that takes into account the wind velocity, the grade, the kind of conditions, the weight of the train, the direction it's moving, and has the ability, for instance, if in the Chatsworth accident, when the engineer ran the red light, there would have been warnings that had gone off all over the train. And had the engineer not responded, it would have started slowing the train itself immediately. In New York, where they went into that curve at 80 miles an hour, same thing. The train would have been taken over by positive train control. In railroads in particular, because of the human element and the mechanical element, you need redundancy in the system. And that's what positive train control does. It's also key because it talks to the other. It's interoperable, as we say. All the trains talk to each other. And that is a real key to make this work. And a lot of properties around the country still haven't done it. They're waiting for someone else to pay for it, someone else to do this, someone else to do that. And to the credit of the Metrolink board and its the folks that work there, we made a decision. It would be hard. Some things wouldn't get done that we wanted to get done. But safety is foundational. And every decision at Metrolink starts and ends with safety. So to us, it was a no-brainer. You know, and I know Keith and I have talked about this. Art Leahy, who was on before, talked about this. You look around the country and all the excuses some of the railroads make for not doing it. You know, it's not going to happen to us. It just happened to them. Why are you guys in the West Coast always trying to tell us what to do? And all we're saying is, look, we don't want you to ever have to go through what we did. We don't want your passengers or your crews or your employees to go through what we did. This is a life-saving technology. It's not a question of if someone will die without positive train control. It's when that accident occurs, because it will occur, and we've seen them. And the sad reality is, aside from, in addition to the loss of human life, that at the end of the day, when those railroads get done paying out liability and the insurance companies and everything else, it would have been a lot cheaper just to put positive train control in and not have that problem.
So I have a story I want to tell, but before I go there, it was $200 million to put this system in place. And there was a cap on how much money could be paid to victims to be able to deal with all the issues they've had to deal with. That was also $200
coincidentally,
million.
Coincidentally,
and that was set up by the federal government.
That's right.
And it turns out it wasn't enough. Even the judge said so, right?
Right. Correct. And, you know, and Keith was very instrumental in this, and we disagreed in the beginning, but at the end, begrudgingly, I came to believe that he was right. You know, I wanted to... And I know Keith did too. I wanted to take Connex to the cleaners. I wanted them out of business. They were that bad an operator. But we made a decision through Keith's leadership. The board made the decision. It was most important to make sure the victims were compensated quickly. We didn't want it dragged out for years and years and years. So we gave up going after our pound of flesh, if you will, from Connex in order to get as much as we could to the victims as fast as possible.
Now to be fair, I've not talked to Connex, and they are still in business,
yes.
But not with you, not with Metrolink.
Not with Metrolink.
Right. Right. Yeah, the Connex was set up as a limited liability corporation, so I don't think they still exist, but the company behind them is a French conglomerate, Veolia Transportation. Right. You know, the cause of the accident was clear from the NTSB. It was their engineer text messaging. And you're right, the $200 million cap was not enough. It had been established back in the 70s due to some Amtrak accidents. And it was frustrating for us because we couldn't bridge the difference. I mean, we weren't allowed to do that by law. We can't make gifts of public funds. And Connex,
we would have if we could have.
Yeah, Connex could have stepped up. So what we had to do was, look, positive train control was going to be years off. So there were steps that we took immediately and steps on an intermediate level. And then with positive train control, we had no money. The technology had never been done in operational service in the country. NTSB said it exists. Somebody's got to implement it. And we did it. So if we could do it, there's nowhere in the country that should have an excuse. And what really irks me is to have fought so long and so hard to get this done here and to have others not do it and then to see people perish that didn't have to die. Mm-hmm. I can't bring the people from Chatsworth back. I wish I could. But their memories and knowing them, the people that were victims, mm-hmm. Who perished, and the people who live with lifelong memories and injuries and their families, I owed it to them, as Richard and the rest of the board did, and we made sure that we took steps to make sure this couldn't happen again.
I'm gonna get off this point in a moment, but the $200 million that was capped, that has now been changed to be to be in sync with cost of living, right? Well, so that's been improved.
It's been indexed for inflation. Whether it actually is sufficient given, for example, if the high-speed rail system ever goes into effect and you have a catastrophic accident on that, would that be enough? Probably not.
And Claudia, you know, we don't really need to know how much money you got. But I am curious that, you know, did you feel that whatever you got from this to help deal with whatever issues you had to deal with was helpful?
It was helpful. I'm thankful for what I got, but I do remember so vividly being in front of the judge at the end of all of this and him just kind of shaking his head and saying he just felt like he had a little pretend kit for kids with Band-Aids in it, passing out to all these people because of that cap. That was such a low cap. I don't think anyone ever dreamed there'd be this many deaths in a rail accident. And try as we might, we couldn't get anyone to change that cap. So.
No, and, you know, as Keith said, it was set up 20 years earlier. It was never adjusted. And as Keith just said, while there's a COLA in it now, cost of living increase, there was no attempt to make up the difference of inflation for those 20 years. So it was the $200 million plus a COLA. So, and you know what the reality is? The money helps, but it doesn't make it okay. Yeah. As Keith said, you know, it doesn't replace. It just makes it a little easier to get through it.
Well, you got bills. There are people that didn't die. There are people that have had lifelong injuries.
And will continue, yes.
And they'll continue to have to pay for that.
Yeah.
Even with insurance, you're still stuck with a copay.
That's right.
So, I mean, there are things other than just helping families who lost somebody. Yeah. But you know, I want to just reflect on what it was like for me that day, because I think it's an interesting story. You guys, you've known me for a long time, and I like to get on a story and find out what I can find out so I can tell everybody. And it happened to be that I was at the Fox 11 Van Nuys Bureau, which is at Van Nuys Airport, where we keep Skyfox, our helicopter with a camera. And we were heading, it's going to sound a little weird, but the assignment for me that day was to go to Rancho Cucamonga, which is a couple hours away, with light traffic. And there was a representative from a company that makes shoes. It was Monkey something. The name is escaping me. But it was the shoe company that Sarah Palin liked for shoes. And at that time, John McCain and Sarah Palin were running for the top office in the country. And as we were heading to the 405 freeway, my assignment editor at that time, Marla Fain, was screaming at us to get to this location.
Turn
where
left.
This crash. Yeah, turn left, not right. Yeah. That's exactly what happened. Well, we're heading toward the crash site, and we're in a parade of police cars and fire trucks and ambulances. And my photographer, Armando Hernandez, recognizing how serious this was going faster than the police cars, which made me a little bit nervous. But they didn't care about us because they had bigger fish to fry, so to speak.
They knew
what was ahead. And so we get to the scene, and this was one of these very rare situations where we were the only crew inside the yellow tape. And when I say that, what authorities will do is they'll put out a perimeter of yellow tape around to keep media and public back so they can do the work they have to do. But we got there so fast that when they put up the yellow tape, we were inside. And so there's no nice way to put it. It was like standing there watching the walking wounded. It was terrible. And we're live, and I'm talking to people. I remember one instance that has never left me, and that's a woman who I saw who was a neighbor, a lovely woman, and as soon as she saw what happened, she grabbed blankets and she grabbed water and she grabbed whatever she could and ran out there and started helping people, bless her heart. And at some point, I stopped her. We're live, and I said, hi, what's your name? And we're live, and what's this been like for you? I've seen you out there trying to help people and do what you can to be, you know, a good soldier here in this army of people trying to help people. And she started to talk, and I didn't realize for another minute that she was in shock. Mm-hmm. And she said something, and sorry, this is a little graphic, folks, but she said, you've never seen anything until you have somebody in your arms and their head is cracked and there's their brains are affected. They're coming out. It was horrible. Yeah. And so people saw things that day that they'll never forget. And there are people that have suffered from PTSD and things like that as a result of this. But I know that sometimes I can't remember what I did yesterday. Right. But 10 years later, I can't forget what I was in the middle of because it was like being in the middle of a war zone.
And that's the thing that, you know, the people who have healed physically from the incident may not have healed emotionally. I have a friend that was in the first car, and he was one of the few that survived. He believes it was because he was sitting backwards, and when the force of the impact hit, he was propelled away from the incursion. But he woke up to a cell phone ringing, and there was an arm across his body, and he thought his arm had been severed. Turns out it was another person's arm. But I'm sure that will be with him his entire life.
And Claudia, I'm sorry. These are difficult things to hear. I know they are.
But, you know, it makes me think about the first responders. Mm-hmm. And I have had the opportunity to speak to a couple, and just the things that are seared into their memory. And like that, the one said this is the worst thing he'd ever dealt with in decades.
There were people that went in there without protective gear just to do what they could to try to save people's lives.
It was like a war zone.
Mitch Englander, who's a city councilman, Reserve LAPD, was in the area, dropped his daughters off, went to the scene. Mayor Villaraigosa spent 24 hours at the scene talking to families, talking to first responders. And, you know, as I said earlier, I stayed back, but I'll never get out of my mind the picture of all the first responders crawling all over that first car. You know, all those yellow slickers on top of that car, like, and just moving everywhere, doing whatever they could to get to somebody. A lot of very brave men and women, civilians as well as first responders.
I don't think that can be emphasized enough. They were very brave. Mm-hmm. Who knew? I mean, it was on fire.
Right.
It could have exploded.
You know, and we take it for granted what first responders do because we're used to seeing them screaming down the streets with lights and sirens. But at the end of that drive, it gets really dangerous and crazy. And these people rush in where people don't go. The rest of us would wish we could or hope maybe in that situation would, but they do it day in and day out. Don't think twice and put it on the line every single day.
They did.
There were many selfless, non-first responder civilians who, you know, put themselves in danger to help
others. Well, like the woman I talked to.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that was a civilian.
And that showed you, I mean, there's a positive side of humanity there that is sacrificing or potentially putting themselves in danger to help others.
I don't think there's any question about that. I mean, it was just throw caution to the wind.
Yeah. For all of our difficulties and all of our problems and all the crap that's going on now, people on situations like this do respond in the right way. I mean, the good part of people comes through. And I think we're all very blessed and very lucky to live where we live and to have the kind of folks around us that are here and respond that way.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's just the worst of the worst kind of situation.
But I was going to say, but as we were saying earlier, and Keith said this very well previously, that, you know, we can't do anything to bring the people back or to make the injuries go away. But what we were able to do is to make sure that at Metrolink is now the safest railroad in America. I mean, that's quite a turnaround in 10 years. Inward, outward facing cameras, the, you know, energy resistant bumpers and all those kind of things.
And let me just break that down, because the bumpers help to cushion the impact.
Correct.
But the cameras are more of a threat.
Well, it's a threat, but also,
it's not live. They're not live cameras. You can't see that back in the control room.
But you do have a tape of it, and it's reviewed of the incident. And for instance, on strikes, when you hit someone, I mean, there is now no doubt what happens. Was it a trespasser? Those cameras. In fact, there's one just real quick. The odd things you learn. We had an engineer who had an epileptic fit. Nobody knew he had epilepsy, including the engineer. And he was thrashing around, and he kept hitting one of the switches, it's like a dead man switch on the train, and it kept getting different signals back. And because of the inward camera, they saw what happened and they redesigned the cab, because it never occurred to somebody that a guy who epilepsy or in a fit or something like that would be able to strike a control and do something. Hmm. So there are positives that come out of all of this, but the most important one is knowing that that all of us collectively, and I don't just mean Keith and me, but I mean all of us collectively, who covered this, who were part of it, who fought for positive train control, have made it possible for people we will never meet to live a longer, safer, healthier life because of all of our collective
efforts. And had that been in place back then, we wouldn't be sitting here having this conversation, number one. Number two, back then, I interviewed you back then, and you said somebody screwed up, and even if there wasn't redundancy, that's a screw-up.
Correct. I mean, you have people and machines. You know, something's going to go wrong, and you've got to make sure that when it does, nobody gets hurt. And that's what we tried to do at the railroad.
I don't think anybody could have expected the level of unprofessionalism of someone who is entrusted with hundreds of people ignoring his focus and focusing on text messaging. And
you know what? I want to double down on that because drivers do that. How many times are you on the freeway and you've got somebody texting behind the wheel? That's what happened on that train, right?
Yep.
Yeah. And that had been going on for a while. The driver had some serious
issues. There was something like 40 text messages, and the last one was 22 seconds before the impact.
Which was probably a clear indication of why he was probably in the middle of drafting one, which is why he didn't even hit the brakes. He didn't see anything in time. But, you know, to your point of drivers texting, people don't understand the gravity of the situation they're dealing with. And, you know, if we're losing one life here because of a texting auto accident and one life there, it doesn't sink into people because they figure that's somebody else. I can drive and I can text and I can do that. And I go down the freeway and I see these people doing it, and it just infuriates me because I know that there can be a very, very tragic outcome when you're not focusing on what you're supposed to be doing, whether it's operating a train, driving a car, or any other job.
I'm curious, when you were an assemblyman, what years were you a legislator?
Well, back when we had stone tablets, 80 to 96.
And back then, what kind of things came up with regard to train safety?
You know, it was pretty standard. You know, I mean, there was always a lot of concern about the quad gates and whether the gates go down, the gates go up, or that kind of thing. But it wasn't something people thought a lot about because, for the most part, when I first got on the Metro board and they asked me if I wanted to go on the Metrolink board also, I said, why? I mean, I didn't know what Metrolink did at that point or how it served. It just, you know, trains are not that part of much of our culture.
And for those listening, Metrolink is our train system here, and Metro is our public transportation, trains and buses and that sort of thing.
Metro, though, is just L.A. County. Metrolink is five Southern California counties.
Right, thank you.
So it's you're right, but it's the commuter rail for those five counties. But, you know, it's a newer system, but ridership is growing, more awareness, and I think, frankly, and Keith and I have talked about this in the past, I think Metrolink is one of the most underrated pluses in L.A., in Southern California, and will be a big part of our future in terms of cleaner air and commute and reducing congestion. But, you know, but railroads were not something. It's not like the East Coast where everybody knows about the railroad. You grew up on the railroad, you know, or you took the railroad.
You know, distractions, though, you can have all kinds of distractions.
Sure.
You know, eating a sandwich can be a distraction. And if an engineer is doing something, whether it's texting, having a sandwich, drinking a soda, not paying attention to the track, or missing the light that's red and not stopping, it would be perhaps the same kind of outcome if it weren't for positive train control, which takes over and stops the train when the human being isn't doing what they should do.
Or in the case of...
call that an overlay, right?
In the case of an earthquake under the new system that will be coming in within a year or two, that 20 or 30 seconds, that P wave, as they call it, comes through before the earthquake, that's enough to make sure the train's not on a curve. The train's not over water. The train's not on a bridge. I mean, 20 or 30 seconds, if you're trying to wake up in the morning, is not a lot of time. But for a train and a computer system like that, you can put that train somewhere much safer before the earthquake strikes.
But one thing to remember is positive train control is not the be-all and end-all. Safety doesn't stop there because positive train control doesn't deal with at-grade crossing. So if there is an incursion, a car on a track, somebody goes around a barrier gate, that engineer has to be focused. And while the feeds on the cameras aren't live, those engineers know that they are systematically reviewed at Metrolink. And if you're violating rules at Metrolink, Metrolink has the ability in their contract with the operator to bar you from the Metrolink system. So if you want to be kicked out of Southern California because you're violating a rule and operate a train in the middle of Nebraska, no offense to Nebraska, but that's what's going to happen if you're not solely focused on your job and that shows up in your review on the cameras. So positive train control is great, but there are other things that still require super focus by the engineers.
I'm going to say that Keith is exactly right. It's one of those things where it takes everybody doing their job. But you know the importance of having that in the cab and having the engineer have situational awareness cannot be understated. But safety is everybody's responsibility, and that's part of the message at Metrolink.
You know, Claudia, you know, we've kind of gone off to an area that I'm not sure how tuned in you are to, but.
Well, it's very interesting. I know that, I mean, it sounds like Metrolink really has taken the leading cutting edge of this whole thing. And it does seem so frustrating to think that the rest of the country isn't catching up. At least parts of it aren't.
Well, there's a federal mandate, right?
Yeah,
well,
But the deadline was 2 years ago. We met the deadline at Metrolink. Most of the country did not, and they got it extended 2 years to this December. So we'll see now.
Some are still asking for more extensions.
Exactly.
And as I was talking earlier, you said we just made it a priority and set aside capital projects to do what we had to do. You just find the money because it's people's lives.
It's not as much fun as the shiny new ribbon cutting that everyone wants to go to, but in terms of people's lives, it's a whole lot more important.
Yeah. But I'll tell you, when you've looked into the eyes of a mother who's lost her 18-year-old daughter in the prime of her life, and you see the pain and the hurt, that's a hell of a motivator to really get you to find a way to do something, regardless of whether it's considered impossible or difficult.
I mean, that's one of the things, and I give a lot of credit to the Metrolink engineers and the professionals at Metrolink, along with BNSF, frankly, Railroad, who stepped up when we hit some rough spots, BNSF, were there. They opened up their back room to us. They opened up all their technical folks and worked with us to help solve these problems. Because as Keith said, positive train control had been something that people have been talking about a lot, but no one had ever done it before. You know, it's this great theory. Now let's find out if it works.
So we talked to Art Leahy earlier, who's CEO of Metrolink, and we sort of heard from him that there's more coming. There's more safety coming. What do you know about that?
Well, it's one of the things Keith talked about earlier. You know, Metrolink, the quad gates, I don't understand people's desire to run around quad gates to save 20 seconds. It is not worth your life.
We're talking about the gates that come down. Stop the cars from going over the track.
You know, it's that race. You're not going to win. There was a guy who was a health food guy, and he had a lot of product, and he was an adrenaline junkie, and he got on some track out by the Burbank Airport, and they were filming a promo, and they thought it'd be really cool to have him get in a three-point stance and start running because the train was behind him. And the train caught him, and the train won. But I don't get people who think that's
a sport. They call that chicken, don't they?
They call it stupid.
It's kind of like, dare you to do this.
Well, you know, it's like objects in the mirror are closer than they appear. Guess what? That train is going to get you. And you cannot outrun the train. And it's just dumb.
And there are safety products that are being discussed. You know, Metrolink was the leader with the crash energy management cars that basically have, you know, it's akin to a vehicle that had a chrome bumper, and now they have crush zones. Well, the Metrolink cars have crush zones. Now, those will help in certain accidents. Those aren't designed for other type of accidents. But there are improvements that continue to be developed. I'm working with a company that's exploring technology that would avoid like the Oxnard incident where some guy got confused, drove down the tracks with a trailer, got stuck on the tracks, abandoned the car in the early morning hours, and then the Metrolink train ran into it and derailed because there was no warning that it was there. So there's the need for additional warning systems. They need to be developed, and it all needs to be a continual work in progress.
I remember that story. I covered that story.
Well, you say, no, and Keith mentioned earlier, the intrusion technology is the next key, so that we can know.
What does that mean, intrusion technology?
No, somebody has gotten into the track space. If a passenger, if a, a pedestrian or a bicyclist or a car stalls on those tracks, knowing that ahead of time and being able to slow down your locomotive or even stop before that happened, before getting there. That, I think, is the next big breakthrough that Metrolink's been experimenting with, as have other railroads, but you know, that's the one in particular that you add that to the crash energy management, to the PTC, to the inward and outward, and now you've got a safety system. But again, people have to maintain it, people have to be on top of it, and people have to remember where they are and what they're doing. There was a line. At one point, there was this discussion when we were first doing the cameras about the right to privacy of the engineer, and our response always was, "Appreciate your right to privacy, but it ends where my right to live becomes jeopardized."
Yeah. Well said. Yeah. I mean, I totally understand that. When I went into the locomotive for this anniversary, and we shot video of the track as it went around the bend and where it happened, and tried to recreate sort of not an actual recreation, but the sense of what happened on that track. They told me I couldn't have my phone on. They told me that I wasn't allowed to text in the locomotive. I'm not the engineer, but they didn't want anything that caused a distraction, including me. So I thought that was pretty good, and I didn't volunteer a question for that. It was told to me as part, like, this is how it's going to be. Just like they told me we had to have shoes that had a defined heel, and I thought, what the heck? What the hell? I mean, why in the world do I need a defined heel? I mean, shoes have a heel. And they said, well, if you try to get up into that locomotive and you're climbing up the rungs of the locomotive way up there, on the rungs, if you don't have a defined heel and you're wearing, like, sneakers or something, you can slip off.
And they were worried about you having those high spike heels, right? <You're>
right. Right. Let me get a final thought. Let's start with Keith and end with Claudia.
I think the final thought is on the 10th anniversary that the Metrolink victims and their families have never been forgotten by many people, if not everyone at Metrolink. I know there hasn't been a day that's gone by that I haven't thought about them, you know, prayed for them. And it's frustrating to not have been able to turn back the clock and prevent the accident, but the best way of honoring their memories was to do what we did at Metrolink and to lead the country in safety improvements so their deaths and injuries weren't in vain. And I'm proud of the fact that we did that what was identified as one of the top 10 safety improvements in railroads history in the past 100 years.
Richard? Just echo everything Keith said. Appreciate how you and Fox are doing this program, because we have to remind people. You know, there are a lot of people not born 10 years ago or don't remember 10 years ago or weren't in California or don't know what took place, or more importantly, or as importantly, what changes have taken place since then. So the fact that you have us here, we're very appreciative of the chance to tell folks that Metrolink is the safest railroad in America, but that it never stops.
And we never want to stop forgetting the Doyle Sousers of the world.
Exactly right.
Claudia.
Which is why we do this.
Right. And I do appreciate having a chance to talk through this and listen to all of this, too, because it just makes me realize that if what we have been through, what happened in some way has brought about positive good for the future generations, and it sounds like it has, and we're at the beginning of a lot of change, too, for the rest of the country, that is some bit of a salve to the wound. And I'm pleased to hear all this.
I want to thank those three and everyone that I talked to in preparation for this podcast. I was there, as I said, one of the first on the scene. And I will tell you, the memory is still lingering in my mind. Thanks for joining us. See you next time.